we're saying to ourselves, this is a place where we're going to allow nature to have priority, so to speak. And it's a sort of a sense of humility, in a way, to acknowledge that maybe when we think we understand things, we always want to manipulate them. And so a wilderness area is a place where we don't manipulate, but it's also a generosity, in a sense, almost to put limits on ourselves. In other words, not say that we're going to exploit every last acre of land. We're not going to cut down every last tree. We're not going to drill oil in every last piece of the landscape.
Good morning. I'm Tommy Howe, and welcome to another edition of Tree Huggers International, broadcast from the studios of KBZT, FM 94.9 in San Diego. Tree Huggers International is a weekly natural science and environmental affairs program dedicated to the preservation of parks, wilderness, and special places. From the beaches to the mountains to the deserts, this is Tree Huggers International. Be careful and use this show with caution, because you might just learn something. A lame duck session of Congress is currently underway, and there are hopes among environmentalists and wilderness advocates. Some 21 wilderness and wildland protection bills currently in legislative circulation may be passed by the outgoing Congress as an omnibus public lands bill. A similar bill was passed in early 2009, but with the 111th Congress getting ready to hang it up and call it a day, lawmakers from both parties have some long wish lists. We at Tree Huggers International hope the coming shift in the political landscape will at least compel the outgoing Democratic majority in the House to make a last-ditch push for a public lands legacy bill. Such moves are not unusual. The first California Desert Protection Act was passed after the calamitous returns of the 1994 midterms, which saw Death Valley and Joshua Tree elevated to national park status and provided for the creation of the Mojave National Preserve. In the wake of the 1980 elections, the outgoing Carter administration worked with Congress to push through the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, which created or revised the status of 15 National Park Service properties and provided for the designation of nearly 125,000 square miles of new public lands, of which a third was set aside as wilderness. With hopes for an omnibus public lands bill in mind, I'd like to present an encore presentation of Tree Huggers International featuring George Werthner, a writer, photographer, and ecologist with 34 books to his credit. George currently lives in Vermont, but he's no stranger to the West, having received his undergrad at the University of Montana before picking up graduate credits at UC Santa Cruz and the University of Oregon. George has spent a great deal of time on the trail in our national parks, national forests, and wilderness areas, and among his many books, he produced a two-volume guide to California's wilderness areas in the 1990s, and he's also the author of a new book about the damage caused to the environment by reckless off-road vehicle use called Thrillcraft. George Werthner, welcome to Tree Huggers International. We are very happy to have you here today.
Well, thank you, Tommy. I'm pleased to be here.
You've written books not only about California, but it seems every state in the Union, certainly all the regions. You've written about the Adirondacks in New York State, the Rocky Mountains, the Sierras, and individually about Montana, Idaho, Alaska, the Pacific Northwest. Do you have a favorite region or a favorite part of the country? I guess it's kind of like asking what your favorite food is.
It's more like saying, who's your favorite child or something. I have different things. I love California in a lot of ways because of its diversity, terrain, climate, and so forth. It's a fabulous place. I also like Alaska just because of the, sort of the vastness and sense of wildness there that you get that's hard to replicate anyplace else. And then I really like the greater Yellowstone ecosystem up in Montana, Wyoming, as maybe a nice compromise between Alaska and other parts of the country, because it's more accessible than Alaska, so that makes it a little easier and cheaper to be there, and yet it still has a lot of wildlife and tremendous wild country.
Now, you've worked for various agencies as a ranger. You were a wilderness ranger, a river ranger. Is that what you were basically first going to college for in Montana? Because you've got a wildlife biology and a botany degree.
Yeah. Well, originally I wanted to be a fish biologist. And I was a fishing fanatic as a teenager. Fished every day practically after school and on the weekends. And You know, and I thought it would be great to be one of these guys that was writing for hunting and fishing magazines, you know, about traveling around fishing for trout, you know, in Montana or going to Alaska salmon fishing and writing articles for, you know, Sports Afield or something like that. And so I went to school in wildlife biology thinking I would become a fishery biologist. What happened along the way is as I got more into school, college was for me like going to the all-you-can-eat restaurant where there's so many different things to sample. You start, you know, you think you're going to go in there and just have a little macaroni and cheese or whatever you think you're going to have. And then you say, oh, this looks good or this looks good. And so I took lots and lots of courses. And I never did get a degree in fishery biology, although it was wildlife biology. But I got interested in plants, too, through college, you know, which I had no interest really in when I was younger. I wound up taking 28 ecology or ecology-related courses, for example. So if it had the name ecology in it, I took it. If it said, you know, Arctic ecology, I'll take it. If it's, you know, birds of prey ecology, I'll take it, et cetera. So that was kind of what became a basis for sort of a more rounded education, I guess.
Going to school in Montana must have really enticed your outdoor Jones, too.
Oh, it was. It was it was a real eye-opener growing up in the East and then going out to Montana and having, particularly Missoula, where I did my undergraduate. If you were to draw a 100-mile radius around Missoula, there's more designated wilderness there than any place else in the country, and millions and millions of acres of land protected. And you could just go on your weekend, you know, on a hike in something like Glacier Park that people, you know, maybe wait all their lives to go to. And that would be just something for the weekend, you know, or the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness or some of these other major wilderness areas that are found just on the doorstep of Missoula.
Talk to me about wilderness values. What does wilderness mean to you?
Well, there's a number of things. Wilderness I look at as a landscape that's self-willed. In other words, that's under minimal, if any, human manipulation and control. And then I think it also has a symbolic meaning to me in terms of the more formal designation of wilderness or national parks or whatever, in the sense that we're saying to ourselves, this is a place where we're going to allow nature to have priority, so to speak. And it's a sort of a sense of humility in a way to acknowledge that maybe when we think we understand things, we always want to manipulate them. And so a wilderness area is a place where we don't manipulate, and we can sort of see how natural processes operate over time periods and landscape sizes and scales that we normally don't have as our frame of reference. A good example would be the fires in Yellowstone that happened. They were very large fires, and it was able to be large partly because it was a large area of basically unmanipulated landscape that the fires could go through. And we have since learned that such fires, large fires, are not that unusual given a long enough time span. In other words, if you go back several hundred or a thousand years, you'll see that there have been a number of large fires in the Yellowstone area, very similar to 1988. But our usual frame of reference is a human lifetime, so we don't have a good feel. So we think they're unusual when, in fact, they're not unusual. And having wilderness areas, I think, provides an opportunity from an ecological point of view to see that. But it's also a generosity, in a sense, almost to put limits on ourselves. In other words, not say that we're going to exploit every last acre of land. We're not going to cut down every last tree. We're not going to drill oil in every last piece of the landscape. That kind of restraint, that self-restraint, I think are good traits. It's sort of self-discipline, self-restraint. It's the kind of things that I think society as a whole probably values. And wilderness designation is a manifestation, a political manifestation of those kinds of values in a way.
Thinking about it, it's remarkable those political designations even came about in the first place. And you mentioned the word humility.
Yeah.
And that's not really a word that comes up very often in those types of discussions, you know. And it really is wonderful that you are talking about a human lifetime compared to natural lifetimes. I mean, that can be applied to volcanic eruptions.
Sure.
And big earthquakes like we're expecting here in California, everything like
right.
that. How long does it take you to write one of your books? I mean, are these locales you visited over the years, or you just decide to write about a certain area, you spend time there, you research it, and then the information's kind of fresh?
It's both. You know, most of, you know, like the California Wilderness Areas book, a lot of those places, I mean, starting from when I was a freshman in college in Montana, my spring break, I hitchhiked down to California and spent 2 weeks traveling up the coast, and I actually visited like the Ventana Wilderness, for example, on that trip. And then that following summer, a good friend of mine from college was from California, and we spent a month backpacking in the Sierra. So I had experiences starting very early in California, using California as a point. And so when it came time to do the book, I already had some familiarity with the area. And then I went to, I had also gone to grad school here and so forth, which gave me even more time to explore things in California while I was in grad school. So when there were some areas that I'd never been to, but there were other places that I'd been to repeatedly. By the time I did that book, I'd probably been to Yosemite, you know, like 24 times. Some things were very familiar to me, and I might only have to go spend a very short amount of time there just sort of get an update on, you know, from figures on how many acres are protected as wilderness or whatever it is, and just refresh my mind about what plants or animals might be there. To others that I had to spend a little more time on because I'd never been there before.
Do you find some of the wilderness areas, not just here in California but around the country, are they receiving the kind of impact that our national parks do? I mean, the John Muir Wilderness comes to mind. Some of the Sierra wildernesses mm-hmm. come to mind, where you can almost do a lot of day trips into these wilderness areas.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find they are receiving sort of negative impacts?
It's all a matter of scale. You know, there are places where you can go and you can find pretty trashed out campsites and that sort of thing from heavy use. But taken within the whole scale of a million acre or a half million acre or even a quarter million acre wilderness, it's a very small part of it. And typically what my experience has been is that there are a few high use areas that get, you know, 80, and research shows us too, that, you know, 80 to 90% of the use might go to two or three parts of a designated wilderness area. In a way of thinking about it in a non-wilderness sense is like the Yosemite Valley gets the most use in Yosemite, and even if you go to Tuolumne Meadows, even though it's accessed by road, you're going to see a lot less people there. And that's sort of the pattern you see in any wilderness area. There'll be the you know, the wonderful lake campground, campsite, that everybody wants to go to Wonderful Lake because it has this wonderful view. And so those places might see a degree of use that some people might say is damaging. But again, within the context of the whole wilderness area, it's probably relatively small amount of damage. And again, it depends on the kind of use. You know, hikers do less damage than horsebackers, and, you know, on a per person per capita basis. So you can have 50 hikers for every horse, for example. So it just depends on the area. My feeling is in most places, you have some flexibility about where you can choose to go. And so if that's a concern to you, you might not go to Wonderful Lake unless you're just dying to see the view at Wonderful Lake and pick an area that's less popular if the solitude part of it and the less impacted aspects are important to you. And I'll tell you, there are just so many places, even in California here, where when I was researching that book, where I was just shocked at how few people I saw a lot of times. On the other hand, I want to say I like seeing people out hiking too, because I think that that is the way you get the popular support for parks and wilderness and so forth. And people have to have that personal contact. I think there's nothing beats that. So on one hand, I like it when I'll go down a trail and I might see 20 or 30 people hiking that trail. I have to say, well, you know, this is probably a good thing. At the same time, I know from my own experience, if that's not something I want, there are other places I can go quite readily and avoid that as well.
Get that solitude.
Yeah, if that's what I'm choosing.
If you're just joining us, this is Tree Huggers International, broadcast from the studios of KBZT, FM 94.9 in San Diego. I'm Tommy Helm, and we're joined in the studio today by George Werthner, a writer, photographer, and ecologist with hundreds of magazine and newspaper articles and 34 books to his credit, including the book Thrillcraft, The Environmental Consequences of Motorized Recreation. And we're talking about wilderness areas in California and around the country. To learn more about George's books and pursuits, check out his blog at www.werthner.blogspot.com. And Werthner is spelled W-U-E-R-T-H-N-E-R, werthner.blogspot.com. You can also see George's photography website at www.werthnerphotography.com. And again, Werthner is spelled W-U-E-R-T-H-N-E-R, werthnerphotography.com. And the tie-in website for George's new book, Thrillcraft, The Environmental Consequences of Motorized Recreation, is www.stopthrillcraft.org. You know, a lot of the desert wilderness areas here in California were set aside by legislation in 1994, and there is significant impact in a lot of the California deserts from off-road vehicle use. We've also seen snowmobile use happening in Yellowstone. We've seen a lot of snowmobile use, unregulated snowmobile use, happening in the Hoover Wilderness, mm-hmm. in the Sierras. What's a way that at least off-road vehicle use can exist side-by-side with wilderness areas?
Well, of course, by definition, you can't have motorized stuff in a designated wilderness. But even, you know, in terms of non-wilderness areas, I think that the off-road vehicles, unless they're just restricted to, say, a road, a gravel road or some other already disturbed kind of and highly impacted, and also, I might say, designed for vehicle traffic. In other words, it has culverts and it has other things to minimize the impact to the environment. It's hard to see how that use can go on, at least over the larger landscape, without some sort of limits and restrictions being put on it. And I think that we're coming to that point, that recognition that there has to be restrictions, because two things are happening. The motorized vehicles are becoming more powerful with actually different kinds of vehicles that can go to more places. So what's happening is you're having a shrinking of wildlands. It's a matter of space and time. If you're walking, it might take you all day to go 10 or 20 miles, depending upon how fast you are. But you can, of course, cover that in less than an hour on a vehicle, even in rugged terrain. This is more of a social thing, but it shrinks the sense of solitude and space by that. That's one of the things. Then you have things like noise and air pollution and other things that come along with, at least if there's a lot of motorized use, that are also impacts. I mean, even it may sound trivial to some people, but most of us live in pretty noisy environments. And it's getting to the point where just quiet is a big value. And it's partly your expectations, too. When you go into a remote place like the desert or something like that, where it's naturally quite quiet, and then that stillness is disrupted by a lot of noisy machines, that takes away from, you know, your personal experience of it. And there are other more subtle impacts that may go on, everything from more sedimentation in the streams that might affect fish and aquatic animals. Even an interesting study I came on, which, just to give you an example of, there are toads that live in the desert that come out when it rains to breed. And they use as a signal to come out is the sound of thunder. And so if you have a lot of ORV use close by, it sounds like thunder. And so the toads come out when it may be perfectly dry out and not able to breed. And in fact, it may even kill them. It might be lethal to them because they, you know, their skins could dry out rapidly if it's very hot and dry. That isn't obviously going to affect all toad populations or anything like that. But if there's no limits on where ORVs can go, then you're going to have more and more of those effects, perhaps to the point where it is a negative.
And that's one of the arguments that a lot of off-road folks will put forward. It's like, well, we need greater amounts of space because we're on machines that take us further. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's the best argument for designating more space for off-road vehicle use, because there's no one that says you can't get off your machine and just get on your feet and go wherever you want.
It's usually a one-way impact. In other words, most ORVers, if they're totally honest, unless there's so many hikers that it gets to be a problem, are not going to be negatively impacted by somebody hiking. But conversely, if you are a hiker, you are probably going to be impacted. It's a more of a one-way kind of thing.
Well, and the argument is, if you don't want to hear machines, mm-hmm. then don't go to Johnson Valley. Don't go someplace where there are going to be a lot of machines. And obviously in California and other places, you do have that opportunity. But on the other side of the coin, if I want to go to some place like the Imperial Dunes, which is called Glamis locally, it's a reasonable expectation that I'm going to bump into machines out there. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, I, as a hiker, do not go to those places.
Right.
And in a way, you sort of cede this public land over to just one type of use.
Exactly. You know, here's an analogy, again, I might use. I have a four-wheel drive pickup truck, which particularly in Vermont is a good thing to have because of the snow and icy roads. But I use it to get from point A to point B. The purpose of the four-wheel drive is safety driving on the roads. Same with a motorcycle. It can be a means of transportation, but when you take that vehicle and you turn it into a recreational thing, and part of the recreation is based on basically tearing up the land or pounding the land, which is exactly the wording from all these ads, you know, go out and pound the land, go out and tear up the land, then I see that as an inappropriate use of public resources. It's sort of like, would we be tolerating somebody going into a city park and doing UEs out there and tearing it up? This is public property. This belongs to everybody. That means nobody has a right to degrade it significantly so that it is no longer as useful to everybody else. So there are certain expectations that come with public land. If you were an ORV person and you wanted to go in your own backyard and tear it up, you know, have fun. I'm not going to say anything about it, unless, of course, I was the neighbor and the noise bothered me. But in terms of the damage to the land, you can probably get away with that. But it's not right to do that on public domain. This is something we all have to share, and we have an obligation to leave it, hopefully, in better shape than we found it, but at least no worse shape than we found it. And that's just a sort of a civic responsibility that I think goes with use of that public property. It's just like borrowing a book from a library. You don't go borrow the book from the library because you have fun tearing pages out. You tear out the pages out of a library book. Nobody would say that's appropriate. You borrow a book from a library, you got to put it back in the condition you got it from. And that's the same with public land. You don't go out and tear up the public land just like tearing up a library book. All these things are a relative sort of thing. You know, one passage by a snowmobile is probably not that damaging to the landscape. But if you have thousands of them, then it becomes significant.
What are some of your favorite places in California? And then what are some of your favorite places just around the country?
In California, I really like the High Sierra for obvious reasons. Lots of lakes, lots of water, dramatic peaks, and large. You know, the first time I went up on a high peak in the Sierra, I was like 19 years old or something on that month-long backpack trip. And it was the first time I'd ever climbed a high peak. And I got up, and as far as I could see, were just peaks and mountains. And there are very few mountain ranges, people may not appreciate that, in the whole country that are that way. I mean, other famous mountain ranges like the Tetons or the Wind River Range, they're basically one uplift. And if you get up on a high peak there, you look out and you see valleys and plains off on the sides. Whereas on a lot of the high peaks in the Sierras, it's just the mountains go on and on and on, unless you're just looking right down on the Owens Valley. So that's a thing about it. I really love that. I also like the northwest corner of the state where the Trinity Alps and the Marble Mountain Wilderness is located, the Siskiyou Wilderness and so forth. That is an area that's a lot more remote than people might expect. If you take that northwest part of California, north of Santa Rosa and all the way up to the Oregon border and then out to the Central Valley by Redding, and you were to look at the population density there, it's actually a lot lower than places like western Montana that people think is a wild place. There's no city the size of Missoula in that whole region. You know, Eureka is the largest town, basically. There's no major population centers anywhere in that whole region. And And so it's a remarkably remote part of the state. And so I really enjoy that area quite a bit. And also because of the great diversity and trees that are found there. There are places there where I believe it's in the Russian wilderness, where there's an acre of, I think it's an acre, where there's 18 different species of trees found on that 1 acre of land. So the diversity you find up there is tremendous. And then I like I like some of the coastal areas, like the Ventana Wilderness. I have these images, again, from one of my first times. I had a college friend who was from Monterey, from Carmel. And my freshman year, I think it was, we drove down from Montana in June and went up in the Ventana Wilderness. And just, you know, looking out on the Pacific Ocean from up on these high peaks, you know, and seeing whales spouting and all the kinds of activity that you have there right along the ocean. There are very few places. And you got Coast Highway 1 there. But the sensation is basically that you're on this mountain range right on the edge of the ocean on the Pacific.
It's terrific. The Central Coast is really something else. And I think people understand that the Redwoods and that area is really remarkable wilderness, and it is very wild. But there are a lot of places around Santa Barbara and Ventura and up north towards Big Sur, Cambria, that are just remarkable areas.
Well, you know, you just mentioned Santa Barbara. Another thing, when I was doing the book, I didn't realize until I did the book was how much wild country there is just outside of Santa Barbara. It's well over 1 million acres that's designated wilderness at this point. And that area, it reminds me of being in Mexico just because of the chaparral and some of the other things. And so there's this – it's sort of like being in Mexico, but, you know, like Baja, Mexico, but being, you know, north of the border because of the vegetation. And that's part of the attraction, of course, of California is all these different places. And the Ishii Wilderness up by Mount Lassen in the spring when the wildflowers were in bloom. I mean, just all over through this oak savanna woodlands. It's just – unbelievably gorgeous. And if you read things like some of the descriptions that John Muir made of California when he was first here, like coming over the Coast Range into the Central Valley, and he describes seeing flowers across the whole Central Valley just full of bees, and then the Sierra Nevada all snow-capped on the horizon. And that image in microcosm I've seen in different parts of California even today. You know, you don't have the whole Central Valley. It's been turned into agriculture mostly, but you can go to some place like the Ishii Wilderness and get a sense of the what the landscape that John Muir saw, you know, the 1860s and 70s was like beyond California. Again, I mentioned the greater Yellowstone ecosystem area. I just find Yellowstone area magical in part because of all the wildlife that you see there. The elk, the moose, the bighorn sheep, the grizzly bears, the wolves, all that sort of just adds to the magical experience of being in that area. Alaska has a vastness to it that's hard to imagine down in the lower 48 states, what it's like where, you know, where you get up on a mountain and you may be able to look out, you know, for hundreds of miles, and there isn't a road out there in all those hundreds of miles. And you get to a different rhythm when you're out for a long time. It happens subtly, but you kind of realize, you know, we joked about it. We were in Glacier Bay one time. This is after about a 7th or 8th week. And we thought about, you know, like the ocean out in front of us was sort of like our Bayview window. In other words, the sense of that this had become our home, as opposed to just some place that was just, you know, visiting on a weekend. It almost became that the normal actions of daily living was being outdoors all the time.
Any current projects you're working on? Any publications we should keep our eyes open for?
I am working on a book about mountaintop removal coal mining in Appalachia and its impacts. And that's a significant twist in the mining. Most of the mining in that area used to be underground mining. And then it was found that they could blow off the tops of mountains, basically, and get at the coal seams. It's surprising. I mean, they may be going after a coal seam that's only a foot thick, and they'll blow off the whole top of a mountain to get at that coal seam. And then they take all the debris and they dump it into the streams.
Yeah, they're wiping out watersheds in West Virginia and places.
And
like that.
And the irony of it, too, is this is a very poor area, Appalachia, and this type of mining requires far fewer people. So to get the same amount of – and this is why it's attractive to the coal companies – to get the same amount of tons of coal by this method, by the old methods, you might have had to have 500 miners. Now you can do it with 25 miners. Even though it's having all these impacts in the region, to the people of the region, it's not really enriching even the locals aren't even, you know, getting jobs out of it. At some point, you could conceivably see, because these coal seams go through the whole Cumberland Plateau, you could see where you could eventually take off all the mountaintops there, you know, over time if that were permitted. And you have other residual things happen because they log off all the trees, and that changes the hydrology in the streams. You get more flooding and so forth. And the coal dust or just the explosions. I met people who, they have a mine a mile upstream and 24 hours a day, about once an hour, there are explosions going off as they're blowing off the parts, you know, to get out the coal seams and try to sell your house in, you know. Your house becomes worthless. And so a lot of these people are stuck there because they can't sell their house to move anyplace else. And they get no compensation. This is the kind of externality that happens with a lot of things, where the people that are making the money, in other words, the coal companies, are not paying the full cost. I mean, if there were some way to figure out the cost, at the very minimum, those people who are having to put up with the noise and the coal dust and the devaluation of their houses, they don't get any benefit out of it. All they get is the negatives.
George, I'm so glad you were in town. We're able to arrange this. Stay in touch. The next time you're in the area, keep tabs, and we'll get you back on the program.
Thank you, Tommy. I'd love to do that.
We'd love to talk more about this book you've got coming up. This is really an important topic, and it's certainly something that we haven't touched on this program.
Be wonderful. I'd love to talk about that.
We will talk to you next time.
Okay. Thank you.
That's going to wrap things up for this week's edition of Tree Huggers International. Thanks once again to author, photographer, ecologist, and friend of the show, George Werthner, for coming by and for a great conversation. To learn more about George's books and pursuits, again, you can go to his blog at werthner.blogspot.com. And Werthner is spelled W-U-E-R-T-H-N-E-R. werthner.blogspot.com. You can also see George's photography website at www.werthnerphotography.com. And once again, the tie-in website for Thrillcraft, the environmental consequences of motorized recreation, is www.stopthrillcraft.org. That's stopthrillcraft.org. And we'll have all this information up on the Tree Huggers International website. The opinions and views expressed on Tree Huggers International do not necessarily reflect the opinions and views of the staff and management of FM 94.9 or Lincoln Financial Media. And as producer, I am solely responsible for this program's content. Questions, complaints, concerns, compliments, go ahead and email me at tommy@fm949sd.com. And for more information on Tree Huggers International and to hear previous editions of the show and download MP3 podcasts of Tree Huggers International, go to www.treehuggersintl.com. That's treehuggersintl.com. And you can also find Tree Huggers International via the FM94.9 website at www.fm949sd.com. This is Tommy Howe for Tree Huggers International from the studios of KBZT, FM94.9 in San Diego. We'll be back same time next Sunday morning with another take on natural science and environmental affairs as we continue our mission to preserve parks, wilderness, and special places on Tree Huggers International. Enjoy the rest of your weekend, and be well.